is a dominant presentation.
So sankhara, the etymology of it is from kar, to do, and sang, meaning together. Right? So it has this idea of doing or creating or making together, something like that. Now, so that's an etymological meaning, which doesn't tell us too much about actually the applied meaning of it. The word sankhara in the pre-Buddhist time was, one of the meanings of it was, it has a meaning of construction. Okay? So, building construction. Right? You want to build a house, then you can construct it. And that's mentioned in one of the very famous verses of the Dhamma, which is the Anekajati Samsaram verses, which is what the Buddha said just after his enlightenment, yeah? After countless births in samsara, wandering, seeking but not finding the house builder. Yeah? And then he says, Gahakaram Gave Santo, seeking the house builder. But then he says, Visankara Gatang Chittang, this mind has become Visankara, devoid of sankharas, or perhaps deconstructed. Yeah? The mind is deconstructed. And so this word is like the ridge pole is demolished, the roof's been taken off, and the house has been torn down. It's all deconstructed. It's visankara. So that gives you one idea of what sankharas might mean. Another idea of what it means is it's one of the many Vedic terms used for the ritual. Yeah? So the Vedic rituals is a sankhara. Kinds of things working together in a coordinated way in order to bring about a constructive result. Okay, so that's another mean, and you can see how that's kind of related to the building idea, right? So building is kind of similar, right? You have all these different materials, to clear the land, and you get the wood and so on, and then you get people with different skills and things to put it together. You sankhara it, and then you have a constructive result. So these are some of the ways that the word sankhara is used in the pre-Buddhist tradition. Now in Buddhism, we find sankhara is used in a couple of different ways. In a number of different ways. One way that it's used, which is less common, I'm just thinking now, just I don't want to miss out on any. First of all, I started out with two, then I had three, now I've got four. There might be some more that pop up as we go. So one way that it's used, sankhara is used in the sense of energy. In the spiritual sense, so the same meaning as samavayama or samapadana, like right energy or right effort. So sankhara is used in exactly that way, as a synonym for energy or effort that you apply in your spiritual practice. Another meaning that sankhara sometimes has is cause. Okay, so we also find sankhara used as a synonym for paccaya, nidana, hetu. These kinds of words that just mean the cause or the reason for something. Yeah? Sankhara can be a cause. Notice the similarity in all of these meanings, that it has some kind of energy, some kind of power to it. Right? But the more important meanings of sankhara are twofold. The first important meaning of sankhara in the Buddhist text is intention. Okay, so sankhara means an intention. And that's actually the most common meaning that we find for it. And it's in that meaning that we find sankhara in dependent origination. Avijja paccaya sankhara, sankhara paccaya vijnana. So in that context, ignorance is a condition for sankhara. Sankharas are the condition for vijnana, for consciousness. So without going into too much detail in dependent origination, but think about that in terms of the story of Genesis, right? Dependent origination is the Buddhist origins, right? What happens in Genesis, right? First of all, there's nothing. There's darkness. Yeah? Yeah? Just darkness, chaos. This is avidya. Yeah? And then God says, let there be light. Yeah? This is the sankhara. Yeah? It's an act of will. So in this sense, sankhara is an act of will. And then when God says, let there be light, then there was light. Yeah? And that's consciousness. Yeah? Consciousness is the light. So this is that same kind of pattern that we're seeing echoing, that's reflected in these kind of mythic tales, that's also put in a psychological and philosophical sense in the Buddhist scriptures. So think about how our life is. Think about how nature is. Think about how the world works. You know, you wander through life, and things are kind of chaotic, right? Things don't have order to them. Right? Well, they have order to them. You don't necessarily perceive that order, right? So things appear to be chaotic, meaningless. Right? And so this is like that kind of avidya that we in our lives. Unless we learn, unless we know, unless we have some wisdom, then we're lost. Yeah? But from that sense of being lost, we make choices. Yeah? We don't know what those choices are. We don't know what it is that we're doing, and yet we have to make those choices anyway. And those choices lead to some kind of result, right? And that conditions our awareness, it conditions our consciousness, it conditions many other things as well. So we're constantly making choices without actually knowing what are the consequences of those choices, right? I mean, isn't that true? Every time you make a decision at work to do it this way rather than that way, how do you know what the consequences of those choices are? You don't know. And when you make a choice to get married to this person, what's the consequences of that? You don't know. When you decide to buy this house or that house, what are the consequences of that? You don't know what's going to come out of that. Yeah? And every day through our lives, we're making that decision. Are we going to turn right or turn left? Yeah? And that's it. One time when I was coming, driving with a fellow in northern Thailand, and he was driving me back to the hut that I was staying in, and we're driving along a highway, it was an unfamiliar road, and it forked off, there's like two sort of symmetrical kind of forks that was going, and then he came up and he couldn't decide, and he ended up just going up the middle. And we just sat there feeling dumb. Right? So you don't know, is this way the right way or is that way the right way? You don't know. Right? And you can never know what would have happened if you'd taken the other choice. You never know. Right? But generally speaking, either one is better than ending up in the middle. Right? Yeah? So this is this ignorance. We don't know what the future holds. We don't know why we're making these choices. Right? I mean, we pretend to ourselves that we're all kind of rational, you know, we think we have kind of rational decision making and these kinds of things. And to some extent, yes, there is some reason plays some kind of role in it, knowledge and information plays some kind of role, but at the end of the day, there's just a choice. You're going to do it one way, you're going to do it the other. Yeah? So this is this avidya paccaya sankhara. So sankhara also appears as volition or intention in the context of five aggregates, the five khandhas, right? So five khandhas, rupa is physicality, vedana is feeling, sanya, perception, sankhara is volition, and vijnana, consciousness or awareness. So these five khandhas, the five aggregates, have a structure to them, okay? Everything in Buddhism has an order and it has a structure. But that structure is not always easy to discern. In the context of dependent origination, which I was just talking about a minute ago, the structure is one that unfolds over time. Okay, so dependent origination is describing a process that unfolds over time. When we're talking about the five aggregates, the five khandhas, we're not so much focusing on something that unfolds over time, but we're talking about a structure of things that what's the word? There's a word for it. Synchronic. Okay, you did philosophy, you should know philosophical words. Things that happen all at the same time.
Something happens simultaneously.
Sahajata. Anyway, I know the Pali word is sahajata. So, anyway, that's good. So they're things that are all there at the same time. Okay, and so the five khandhas don't describe a structure of things unfolding in time. They describe a structure of the present experience. Okay, so So at any moment you can discern all of these five things. So as we're sitting here now, we can feel physical things, rupa, we can see things, also rupa, hear things, also rupa. We can feel things, right? We have likes and dislikes, yeah. We feel uncomfortable or comfortable, happy or sad. It's vedana, yeah. We also have perceptions, right? We recognize things. We can recognize words, for example, concepts, language, yeah? We can recognize other people, people's faces, yeah. This is one of the most highly tuned aspects of sanya, is to be able to recognize people's faces and people's facial expressions. Then we have sankhara, which is your intention, your volition, and vijnana is a consciousness, okay? So these are all things that are present all the time, and which make up in some way the structure of our experience. Now one of the points of the five aggregates is to make a clear, or to not to make clear, to show what are those things that we normally will assume to be ourself. Okay, so obviously we take our body to be ourself, we take our feelings to be ourself, and so on. But and especially when we're adults, right? We often take our volition to be ourself, right? I am the decider. Yeah. And this is a very important thing. This is actually part of what becoming an adult means, right? That you can make decisions and take responsibility for those decisions. Yeah? And so that obviously is an essential thing that we all need to do when we grow up. But usually what happens is as we're developing and we're growing, we develop these things which are essential and good in themselves, but we over-identify with them. Yeah? So I'm the decider, I'm the one in control. Right, I'm the doer, and that's what Ajahn Brahm calls the doer, is this sankhara. And if we get stuck on that level, right, then you become a control freak. Right, I've got to decide everything. I've got to make sure everybody fits in with my way of doing things. I can't tolerate other people's ways of doing things. Yeah, everything has to be like that. It can't be another way. Yeah, and you see, people are stuck on this kind of sankhara. So it's not that it's a bad thing, it's just that it's limited. Yeah? So our ability to decide is limited. And so then vijnana is awareness, is the ability to reflect. Yeah? So with vijnana we can reflect and we can see all those things in context. And you can see and understand by reflecting, oh yeah, it's just a decision. It's just an intention. Yeah? It's not the truth. It's not the way things should be. So vijnana is much more seeing about the way things are, whereas sankhara is much more about seeing how the way things should be, right? Changing them to the sort of way you want, bending them to your will. So this is that idea of sankhara as volition or intention. And so of course, again, it has this constructive force, and so volition or intention is what we use to construct things on a literal physical level, right? Anything from a sandwich, right? I want to have a sandwich. I make a decision to make a sandwich. I construct the sandwich out of the component elements of the sandwich. Or I construct a building. Or I construct a corporation. Or I construct a nation. However big the scope of your sankhara is, then you try to construct something within that's achievable within that scope. And so one of the things that the Buddha has said about this sankhara is that it doesn't just work in this life, but is also the energy that powers that process of rebirth, and it constructs future lives in just the same way as it's constructing our present life here and now. And of course, this being the essence of the Buddha's teachings on dependent origination and rebirth, is that when we're talking about rebirth, we don't have to invoke any special metaphysical entity to explain the process of rebirth. Okay? We don't have to invoke a god or the soul or anything like that. We can just look at the ordinary, everyday things that's going on in your mind right now. And it's those same things that determine the process of rebirth, how it happens, where it happens, where we end up, and so on. So just as our choices determine where we end up, right? You all made a choice to be here tonight. Could have made a choice to go somewhere else, but that choice to be here tonight has changed your consciousness. Okay? It's changed your visual consciousness. You can see all these wonderful people. Yeah? if you'd made the choice to go to the pub, you would have seen a bunch of other wonderful people. Maybe they would have even looked more wonderful once you're in your third year than they would have. Right? So this, and not just the visual consciousness, but also the mind consciousness changes as well, right? So because your choices puts you in different contexts, you have different experiences, and that changes how your mind is. Yeah? And so all of us, our minds are different now because we come here tonight and we've conditioned our consciousness and our sankharas in that particular direction. Yeah? So that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. So these are those choices that we're making all the time. Yeah. So, right. So sankharas. So that's the meaning of sankharas as volition, and then the last important meaning of sankharas is sankharas as component things, conditioned things, conditions, phenomena. Probably phenomena might be the best way of. English translation, but essentially what this is the most characteristically Buddhist usage of the word sankhara. Essentially what it means is everything in the world, or everything except for nirvana. Okay? Right? The easiest way of thinking about it. Actually that was controversial in the Buddhist schools. There were different Buddhist schools that argued that different kinds of things could be considered as unconditioned, right? The Theravadan school, in fact, is quite unusual in having only one unconditioned thing, which is Nibbana. Most of the other Buddhist schools had varying lists of unconditioned things, apart from Nibbana, which is kind of interesting. But in this particular case, I think that the Theravadan interpretation is the right one. But okay, so what is this conception of the world, right? So when we step back to that, okay, sankharas is everything in the world. What does that mean? Why did the Buddha choose to use this particular word, sankharas, in this context rather than something else, right? In particular, why did he use a word which had something to do with energy, right? Has something to do with activity. Something to do with change, had something to do with the way that different things all come together in order to create something which has an effect, right? That's the word that the Buddha's using as his kind of, I guess, most philosophically important and precise way to describe what actually the world is made of, right? Now think about it, there are many other kinds of things, words and concepts and approaches that we could use to try to describe what the world is and how it's made up of, right? For example, if we look in philosophy, we can think of, say, Socrates had this idea of the forms, right? The world is made up of sort of abstract, perfect entities called forms, and what we perceive in the world is the kind of the lesser echoings and mirrorings of those forms which we see through our impure consciousness, something like that. And so it's a very different way of thinking about the world. So from a Socratic point of view, the world itself is actually the real things in the world are eternal and changeless and perfect. Yeah? And the fact that we see change is a sign that we're not seeing the world truly. The truth itself is permanent. Yeah? So that's like almost completely the opposite way of seeing things to the way that the Buddha saw them. You know, another way of seeing the world, which is actually quite a tempting way, and a way in which I think a lot of the Buddhist traditions tend to slip back into, but I think it's a more primitive way of seeing the world than the Buddha saw it, was to see the world as comprised of things, okay? Not comprised of energies, but comprised of entities, of objects, yeah? And so this is like the atomic theory, right? So the atomic theory, it had, of course, in Greece of Democritus, and then had various atomic theories in India. So the idea is that reality has a bunch of building blocks, right? So if you take things apart, they're kind of lowest common denominator. They're made of things which are themselves not made of anything smaller. Okay, that's the idea of an atom. Remember, when I'm using atom here, I'm using atom in the old philosophical sense. Right? I'm not using atom in the sense that we understand it in modern physics, which is quite different to that. Right? But in the old philosophical sense of atom is that there is an ultimate small building block which is indivisible and eternal. And it's by combining those atoms that the various forms and so on that we see in the world come to be. So that's another way of looking at it, and one which is, you know, philosophically quite has been quite rich, right? It turns out the world isn't quite as simple as that, but it's quite, makes a lot of sense. But the Buddha didn't go down that road. He didn't talk about the world in terms of entities, right? He talked about it in terms of energies, right? Changes, movements. And of course, this is a point of view which we've become much more used to in modern science and modern physics. Yeah? And many examples of that, obviously, perhaps the most important being Einstein with E equals MC squared. Yeah? So E equals MC squared essentially is saying that energy and matter are two different sides of the same coin. Right? So there's no actual thing, ultimately, which is a matter as distinct from energy. Matter is really just another form or another way that energy manifests itself. And then through quantum theory and string theory and so on, we're also, all of the modern theories of science come back to this idea that that what we're dealing with at the basic level is some kind of energy. And it's some kind of energy which has some kind of effect. Right? Again, this notion of sankhara. That's what you're seeing when you go to CERN and you do particle accelerator stuff and smash so-called atoms and particles and stuff together, right? You're not really smashing particles together. There's no particles there. There's just energies. But when you do that, they will create some kind of effect, right, which can be measured and which you can then build inferences and so on and test your theories on. So these are sankharas. Yeah? So the notion of sankhara applies in Buddhism on a fractal way. That is, it applies equally at any level of scale that you choose. Right? So the sankharas apply to the universe as a whole, rising and passing away, the universes, the cosmos, to the galaxies, to the solar systems, to the planet, to the ecosystem, to the locality, to the individual, to the cells, the organs in the body, the cells in the organs, the chemicals in the cells make up the cells, the atoms in those chemicals, the particles make up the atoms, the energies that make up the particles, and as far down as you want to go. Right? There's no conception in early Buddhism that there's a bottom line. Right? Later Buddhism there was. Later Buddhism said that you can go to some ultimate level of sankharas and say this is the ultimate truth, and it's made up of these kinds of sankharas. Right? And this is what the ultimate bedrock of reality is made up of. And in the Theravada Buddhism, you have a list of them, right? You've got 52 jetasikas, and you've got, what is it, 129, I think, kinds of consciousness and things like that. And these are supposed to be the furthest you can analyze things. And the problem with that is that when you look at it and look at this late Abhidhamma analysis, is that most of it just doesn't make any sense in terms of what we know about the world. One of the reasons it doesn't make any sense is because most of the things that they're talking about are not basic qualities at all, but they're quite high-order properties which emerge from the combination of many other things. Right? Just give you one example would be nutrition. Right? Now, if somebody was to come along today and say nutrition is one of the foundational building blocks of the universe, you'd think they were silly. Right? There's no nutrition element, there's no nutrition atom or particle, right? But according to the Abhidhamma, nutrition, or Oja, is one of the irreducible qualities of matter, so that in every unit of matter you find a little piece of nutrition. And when the nutritious food means that there's more of those nutrition particles in there, right? That's basically the theory, and of course that's not how nutrition works. Nutrition is a high-order property which arises from the combination of lots of different kinds of organic compounds and so on and so forth. So it can't be regarded as an irreducible property. So this is, I think, an unfortunate mistake which the Abhidhamma traditions got into to try to analyze things down to say that they come to some ultimate level of analysis. And I think neither in the Buddhist sense nor in the physical sense is there any have we any reason to believe we have arrived at any ultimate level of analysis, and I don't believe that we have any reason to believe that we ever will do so. Right? I think it's tortoises all the way down. Right? So I'm sure you all know that kind of story, but every time you go to a deeper level of analysis, you find, well, that itself has structure, that itself has complexity, and you can look within that and then find what's even deeper. And I don't think there's any reason to assume that there's actually any bedrock. It's just sankharas, and they interplay and they interact at any different kind of scale. So what we perceive when we meditate is all sankharas, right? Nothing but sankharas, right? Thoughts and feelings and all of these kinds of things. And then you feel a lot of what you perceive in meditation, and this is what some kinds of meditation like the Goenka technique and so on focus on a lot, is scanning through your body, and then you feel all the different energies and things and movements in your body if you've ever done that kind of meditation. And that's kind of very, and that's what they will call them, the sankharas. And so it's difficult to say sometimes. I mean, in some cases those energies and things you feel corresponds, you know, straightforwardly with some physical thing, right? Some stimulus or itch or something like that. But in other cases, it seems to be a bit arbitrary and a bit not quite clear whether this is just something you're experiencing and what the physical reality is, what the relationship is between what you experience and what the physical reality is. But in any case, certainly in terms of an experience, you experience those different sankharas, movements, energies. And when you pay attention, the closer you pay attention, the more deeply you pay attention, just like if you're a scientist, right, and you look at a water or a blob of jelly or whatever it might be, and you know it looks like an entity, but the further you look into it, the more structure and the more detail that it has, the less solid it appears. Yeah? And through physics we know that solidity is absolutely an illusion. Right? And this is what the Buddha was saying all those years ago. It's all just sankharas. It's not a solid desk. This is just energies moving around in space. That's all. And the reason why we perceive solidity it's got nothing to do with the fact that it's more solid than anything else. It's solely to do with the fact that that those energies have some kind of structured pattern. Right? So the energies in a solid matter, the sankharas moving in a solid, are more predictable and more formally structured than other kinds of energies. And so we perceive them through our senses as being solid. Actually, what we're seeing is a more regular pattern. That's what we perceive as solidity. Yeah? And so on with the different kinds of physical qualities. Right? So, for example, heat has a physical quality we feel and we experience it as heat, but in fact, of course, there's no real thing such as heat, right? It's not actually anything that exists. It's just an inference from the speed at which sankharas are moving. Right? And so we this is how we understand heat. Anyway, So the Buddhist idea is that all of these things are sankharas, and in that respect it's very similar to the idea that we have from modern physics. Of course, the Buddha didn't go into all the details of those things, but the basic idea is similar. The difference being that the Buddha was interested in what happens when there aren't any sankharas, right? And this being something which is not part of physics or not part of the kind of the scientific worldview. What happens when sankharas end? Yeah? What happens when there aren't any sankharas? Like we can perceive that on a small scale, of course, right? It happens all the time. You have a thought, the thought ends. You have a feeling, the feeling ends. You see something, that sight changes, it ends. Yeah? Things end all the time. Sankharas are ending all the time. And we know that there's a certain kind of peacefulness to that ending, isn't there? There's a certain kind of peacefulness, like when the Mitra people finish their conference on a Sunday night, and everybody's gone home, and it's just there's a kind of peacefulness, and all that work's done, and now here we are. And or when you finish, if you had a meal with a good friend, and you had a really good meal and a really good conversation, and then it's all finished, and then there's a certain peacefulness to know that that's done. Yeah? Or even in the seasons, like if when the day draws to a close, yeah, there's a certain peacefulness to know, oh, the day's finished, the night's coming. Or when the autumn comes and the nights start to get shorter and so on, and then there's a certain peacefulness to that season. So this is where that very famous verse comes in Buddhism. Anicca vata sankhara upadavaya dhammino upajitva nirujjhanti te sanghupasamo sukho. And so, alas, all conditions are impermanent, all sankharas are impermanent, they're subject to rise and fall. Having arisen, they pass away, and their stilling is bliss. There's some vupassamo sukho. So this is where the Buddha's teaching is so radical. Right? Normally we want more sankharas, we want more things, we want more activities, right? We want to fill our life with stuff. And the Buddha's pointing to that other thing. There's some vupassamo sukho. Even they end. It's peaceful. It's pleasant. Yeah? And that's something that you experience in your meditation. You sit there and you meditate and you go on and on. And you experience, this is the ending of things. This is what happens when things cease. There's some rupasamo sukho. So that's quite nice. And the stilling of all sankharas is what the Buddha called nibbana. Sabba sankhara samato. The samata, the stilling of all sankharas, is one of the words for nibbana. So a little bit earlier we mentioned this famous saying of the Dhamma. Sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe sankhara dukkha, sabbe dhamma anatta. So it's all sankharas, all conditions are impermanent, all conditions are suffering, and all dhammas are not self. Right? So of course, that's immediately a big problem for Buddhist commentators and so on. Then you think, why did the Buddha change? Right? Anicca dukkha anatta, impermanent suffering and not self. Why is it that sankharas are impermanent and suffering, and dhammas are not self? Right? Why? Why? What's the answer?
Tell us about
any ideas? Thoughts? Speculations? Wild theories?
Well, the word Dhamma here refer to just any phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So in a way, that's kind of similar to one of the definitions of sankhara you described.
Well, that's the point. It's similar, but it's obviously different for some reason. Why is it different?
And
what's the difference?
Because nibbana is not self as well.
Because nibbana is not self.
True. So all dhammas then.
Okay.
Nibbana is not sankhara.
Okay.
Nibbana is anatta.
Okay.
It's not me, does not belong to me.
Okay, that's true, right? And that is the most common explanation for this problem that you'll find in modern writings on it, right? And you find that a lot of very good monks, Jnanatiloka, I think, was the first one who came up with that explanation. Jnanapanika and others have followed on for that. However, it was pointed out long ago by Venerable Kemenda Thera but that doesn't really work when you look at how it's presented in context, right? Because you find lots of passages that will say, for example, things like sabbe dhamma anatta yada panyaya pasati ata nibindati dukhe ata nibindati dukhe esa maggo visuddhiya. So something like sabbe dhamma anatta, all dhammas are not self. Yeah, when you see that with wisdom, you become dispassionate and turn away from suffering. Yeah? And this is the path to peace. Yeah? So if what it was really talking about was looking at nibbana, why would you become dispassionate towards nibbana? Yeah. Why would you turn away from it?
You don't turn away.
Exactly, yeah. But that's what it says, right? That's what the context says, and that's only one passage. There are many more that are of similar kind of nature. So it's clearly it's sabbe dhamma anatta seems to me, and this is what Kemenda argued, it's a description of a vipassana meditation, yeah, which is one of the things which leads you to a sense of dispassion, turning away, and towards a realizing of nibbana. But itself is not contemplating nibbana as such. So that leaves us with the problem. What does it mean then?
Perhaps it's just a skillful means to take people out of the,
a rhetorical device. Could be. Could be. I suspect there might be a bit more to it than that. If it was just once or twice, you might think that, but it's quite consistent in quite a few different contexts. No one else? No?
May I just ask, when you were quoting that, you were saying the Sabbath, so one sees the sankharas as dukkha and one turns away. One does not see all the dhammas as dukkha.
No, it says sabbe dhamma anatta yada panyaya passati. When you see that with and like I said, there's quite a lot of contexts that say similar things. Yeah. No guesses? Come on. You just want me to spoon feed you with the answers, don't you? Because that's how you get wisdom, isn't it? Yeah. Alright, okay, I'll spoon feed you with the answer. The correct answer is if you look at usually with these things is you can't really make sense of it unless you look at the context, right? You see, you look at the context of how these things are used, right? Now it's used in a number of different contexts, but one of the most important ones it's used is in the context of talking about what's called Dhamma Titata or Dhamma Niyamata. Dhamma titata means, the word titata means steadiness or stability. Niyamata means lawfulness. Okay? And what these things are pointing to is that these things are basically laws, similar to what we would call like laws of nature or fundamental principles of nature. So in other words, that say impermanence is a fundamental principle of nature. It's just how the world is. And it says whether the Buddha appears in the world or the Buddha doesn't appear in the world, doesn't make any difference. He's not creating impermanence, he's just pointing it out. He discovers it, he understands it, and he points it out and explains it. Right? So this is this word dhamma titata, dhamma niyamata. Right? So impermanence is stable and is a stable law of nature. Now the Buddha comes close to saying that impermanence is permanent. Okay? But he doesn't quite say that. It's a very, very subtle way he uses language. He doesn't quite say impermanence is permanent, but you can see that kind of idea, right? So you say things are impermanent now, they were impermanent in the past, they will be impermanent in the future, they will always be impermanent. Yeah, things will always be changing, right? So impermanence kind of is permanent, but rather perhaps not use that word. It's not permanent in the sense of being an existing thing, but it's just permanent in the sense that, well, things will always behave in that way. It's a pattern that can be observed in those different contexts.
More like eternal.
Yeah.
Eternal, perhaps? Okay, anyway, so dhamma titata, dhamma niyamata. And so impermanence is like that, and dukkha is like that, and so on. Right? So then, sabbe dhamma anatta, what I think that this is pointing to is it includes that dhamma titata. Remember, this is the same context, right? So it says, sabbe sankhara anicchati, and then it goes on to say this is the dhamma titata, this is the dhamma niyamata, and it's using that word dhamma in that context. It says these are dhamma titata, dhamma niyamata. So it's a dhamma in the sense of a principle of how the world works, right? And then the last one then uses the word dhamma in the phrase itself, sabbe dhamma anatta. So this is what I think it's meaning, is it includes the dhamma anatta, that these principles, right, the principles of the natural laws, right, are also not self. Right? You can't really say that the natural laws are impermanent, right? So you can't say that impermanence is impermanent, right? Because then that would mean that impermanence would end and things would be permanent. Yeah? And similarly with dukkha, can you say that, say, for example, the law of gravity is dukkha? It's a bit hard to say that, isn't it? Yeah, maybe it's not entirely clear that's a dukkha, but you can certainly say it's not self, right? So what I think is included in that not self is those dhammas which in the Buddhist tradition is called panyati. Panyati is a word for the kind of laws of nature. So Paññati in a sense, they're just concepts or descriptions of things, but they're descriptions of the way that the world works, the patterns that you can discern in the world. So this is what I think it means when it says sabbe dhamma anatta. It means that those dhammas, in particular, the dhammas of the Four Noble Truths, yeah? Four Noble Truths are true today, they're true yesterday, they're true tomorrow, they're not impermanent, right? The Four Noble Truths are permanent, yeah? Although again, we don't quite say that they're permanent, we say that they're timeless, something like that, yeah? So it's timeless, but they're certainly not self, yeah? So we don't get attached to them, or we don't take these things to be ourselves. Anyway, that's what I think that means.
Are those the sorts of things that the you mentioned that the Theravadins regard only one?
That's right.
Nirvana as being, you know, unconditioned.
Right.
Are those the sorts of things that the other?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. The and in that case, Paññati is concepts, right? Concepts is actually an area of ambiguity in the Theravadin tradition, whether Paññati is regarded as sankharas or not. Yeah, the tradition is wavers on that, and sometimes it say it will, like, and sometimes it seems to act as if they are not sankharas, and sometimes they are. It's a bit like quantum theory in that way. Yeah. Depends on what kinds of questions that you ask. But the problem being, of course, the problem of are these things actually real things anyway? Right? I mean, do the laws of nature exist? From a Buddhist point of view, I don't think you can say that. I think that laws of nature are an inference. Yeah? They're not anything that exists in the world, it's just you observe patterns and you make inferences from those patterns when they're regular. Yeah. But yes, that was in some of the other things which the other schools regard as being unconditioned would be things like, say, the formless attainments. Maybe the attainment of the cessation, some high meditation attainment, cessation of perception and feeling might be regarded as impermanent, as unconditioned. There's various lists in the different schools. Yeah.
How can they say it's unconditioned? It arises as a process, as part of the...
Difficult to say, yeah. Difficult to say.
It doesn't... go along with what the Buddha said, as far as we know in the
Pali script. For sure, yeah. I mean, I would agree with that, but it's also one of the problems with evaluating these things is that we only have one side of the story. So, yeah, I mean, it seems to me in that case that I think the just Nibbana is really the only unconditioned. Yeah.
In science, and the laws of conservation of energy.
Right.
That energy is neither created nor destroyed.
Right.
Mm. And that means the electromagnetic energy will take different forms.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at the Big Bang, you know, in the theory, it will grow. And so then you would have the samsara and nibbana. So
yeah.
The samsara, in some sense, is eternal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? So
well,
in
exactly
that view,
another,
so that's
yeah.
The samsara is that uncreated energy that is conserved, that in science we're looking at samsara, we study the samsara.
Mm. Right, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, it's from playing with some of those paradoxes that you get this kind of Nagarjuna will sort of play with these ideas to sort of try and stretch your mind out. And one of his, people say that Nagarjuna said that Nibbana and samsara are the same. That's what you often hear, but actually Nagarjuna was a very subtle philosopher, and he would never say anything so crude. What he said a couple of statements, but one of the things he said was something along the lines of the first beginning of samsara would be the beginning of Nibbana.
Mm.
Yeah? Wow. But of course there is no beginning of samsara. Yeah? And so he's pointing out the fact that if you don't suffer, yeah, then you don't practice.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? And if you don't practice, you don't realize Nibbana. Yeah? So unless the suffering is there, then there's not the realization of the Four Noble Truths.
Didn't the Buddha say that the origin of sin could not be seen? So his
right.
view also was limited.
That's
you
right,
know,
yeah.
He didn't have some, you know, he knew his limits.
Exactly, and that's you know, kind of the point I was making before with this idea that you can sort of chase knowledge down to some ultimate bedrock. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really not the point. The point is that as far as you can see,
yeah, that's
what there is. Yeah, you can only see to the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if you see past the horizon, you can only see another horizon. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Buddha also said, you know, that when he spoke about the hand, when you picked up a handful of leaves, you did see a lot more leaves than he spoke about.
I know, that's just so frustrating. Imagine how big the Tripitaka would be if you'd actually thought about all those things. Wow, we'd never be finished with Sutta Central. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that, I mean, if you look at how the Buddha taught and these kinds of things, there are even some things which are regarded as basic Dhamma things, right, which the Buddha was actually a bit reluctant to teach, okay? Just give you one example of that was the idea that a stream enterer can only be reborn for 7 lifetimes, okay? So this is quite a well-known piece of Buddhist philosophy, right? It's once you attain the first of the stages of enlightenment, stream entry, then you have a maximum 7 lifetimes after that. But actually, the Buddha didn't want to teach that, and I think that was the detail. And then eventually, Sariputta asked him, and the Buddha said, "Okay, well, I was a bit reluctant to talk about this because I didn't want people to get lazy, right? If they all knew they were going to get enlightened anyway, they'd say, 'Oh, okay, take it easy.'" Right? So that was actually something he didn't teach of his own volition, but he was kind of prompted to do so by Sariputta. Yeah. And so, I'm sure there are many other things. Yeah, so we have to be grateful that there were monks around like Sariputta and Ananda who would keep on pestering the Buddha with all kinds of questions.
Excuse me, Bansi, where is it? Is it in Vinaya or in
that passage is in the sutta somewhere. I can't remember where. I think it's been ages since I've read it. I think it's in the sutta somewhere.
But the sankharas, are they sort of the precursors to karma then? So this is your volition and...
No, sankharas is the same thing as karma.
It's the same thing.
Mm. Mm. So remember the two meanings, which are quite distinct. So one is the narrower meaning, where sankharas is volition, and the other very broad meaning, where it's everything, including volition, but also all conditioned things. Yeah?
Right.
So in that narrow meaning of volition, it's identical with karma. Okay? Now, it has the same root and it has the same meaning. They're both defined as chetana, as intention. Okay, so they're identical. But again, the Buddha is very subtle in the way he uses language. Even though the meaning is identical, the connotation is slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, karma is used in an ethical sense. Sankhara is used in a philosophical sense or an existential sense. Okay. And the meanings overlap and the uses overlap. That's the main emphasis. So when the Buddha's talking about karma, he's talking about doing good and not doing bad. Yeah? When he's talking about sankharas, he's talking about the fact that the world is conditioned and is suffering. Yeah? And so by making those choices, you're continuing that round of suffering. That's why sankharas use, say, independent origination, where it's talking about the round of existence itself. Whereas, say, in the Dasa Kusala Kamapata, the 10 ways of wholesome action, yeah, he uses the word karma, so it's talking about doing good and not doing bad. Yeah. So it's the same meaning, but sankhara is more of a specialized philosophical term. Karma is a more ethical term.
What's
that make
the
sense?
Word sankhapa? Is it
sankhapa?
Sankhapa,
yeah. Sankhapa is also has a very similar meaning. Sankhapa in the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path sort of again has that kind of active directional kind of sense. Is similar. Sometimes it means thought and is similar to vitaka in that sense, of thought. But meaning kind of overlaps with that of sankhara in that kind of narrower sense of sankhara as intention.
So that intention is also habit, isn't it? It can be you might decide you want to go left all the time.
Exactly, yeah, and that's a distinction which is made in the Abhidhamma. It talks about all those kind of different things. Why certain conditions are conditioned in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have the, for example, asevanapachaya is the conditioned by repetition. So if you do one thing, you sort of tend to do that same thing again and again and again. Yeah. But none of these, of course, are absolute. They're always playing with others. Yeah.
That's the notion of Tathagata Gampa that's not really found in the Theravada tradition, is it?
No.
With that nature, yeah. But I've heard from a couple of Theravada teachers who talk about the intrinsic nature of the mind, which is luminous, and that seems to me is like, you know, the concept of Buddha nature anyway. But even in the Theravada, they talk a little bit about that, so it's confusing sometimes.
The problem is that it is confusing, and it's a bit unfortunate because that's just a mistranslation of something that's found in the suttas.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So when the suttas talks about the radiant mind, they're talking about samadhi. Okay, it's not talking about the intrinsic nature of the mind. To even talk about the intrinsic nature of the mind is completely alien to the way that the Buddha talked about things in the suttas. There's no word for it. I'm trying to think of an intrinsic word for the word intrinsic. I don't think there is one. The intrinsic nature of the mind is to be conditioned. Right? It's a sankhara, like anything else. And the Buddha always treated it in that way, you know, like it's the conditions are there for five hindrances, and the mind's murky and clouded and dull, and if the conditions are there for the mind to be clear, then it's clear.
Mm.
So the mind actually doesn't have any inherent nature. And the idea of inherent nature is completely alien to early Buddhism. But there's what happened was that there's one passage in the Anguttara Nikaya which talks about the mind as radiant, but it's talking about it in the context of citta bhavana, which means developing samadhi. And it's basically, it says when the hindrances are there, the mind isn't radiant, and when the hindrances are not there, the mind is radiant.
Originally radiant.
No, all that is just later mistranslations and mistranslations. I don't know. Partly that seems to come because there are some textual problems with that particular passage. It occurs in a part of the Anguttara, right at the beginning, where the suttas are very fragmented. You know? Just because of the editorial process that went on in that particular part of the text. So because they're fragmented, they've lost their context. And if you look elsewhere in the suttas, you find more sort of complete suttas that use similar kinds of language. But give you a much clearer idea of exactly what's going to be taught, right? So this is one of the things to be wary of, is to just, you know, if you just take fragments of things and then give it some kind of meaning, fragments are always misleading. You look at the full thing in this context. In the commentary to that passage, used the word pakati, which means natural. Yeah? And it seems to be from there that this kind of idea of the mind is inherently radiant and so on came from. I think it's a bit unfortunate. But the Buddha says 1,000 times in the suttas, the mind's conditioned. And then, often, I'm not the first person to point this out. I mean, this has been pointed out by dozens of people. That it's just a mistranslation of the passage, and yet somehow it just gets repeated again and again. The mind's inherently radiant. And frankly, it's just attachment.
Mm.
People want to believe they have some essence which is beautiful and radiant and clear. That's what the Buddha was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could we not say rather than mind has potential which is
absolutely
true.
And that is, and that's what the notion of Tathagata Garbha actually is.
Mm.
Right? The Tathagata means the Buddha, Garbha means an embryo.
Mm.
Right? The literal translation doesn't mean, the literal translation is not Buddha nature, that's a Chinese interpretation. The actual Sanskrit phrase means the embryo of the Buddha.
Energy, it has potential to be manifested in different
ways.
And at the beginning of the universe, potential is hidden, and then it starts unfolding.
Yep.
And the mind is like that.
Can I just ask, there's this whole discussion about components of being permanent, that was kind of last words of the Buddha.
It wasn't quite the last. Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah, it was apamada. Vaya dhamma sankhara apamade sampadesa. Things fall apart. Don't give up.
So, is this given to, was it only monks who were there at the time?
No, I thought all the Sangha was there. Yeah, that's the most beautiful summary of the Buddha's teachings, Appamattaena Sampadeta. Two words, Vaya Dhamma Sankara, Appamattaena Sampadeta. Four words in total, two lines with two words each. Four words and completely sums up the whole of the teaching.
Mm. Yeah. So what does he mean by diligence?
It means never give up.